Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. Once more trekking into the murky depths of the cult TV underworld. Joining me as always is my partner in crime though, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hello.
And today we are dedicating the whole show to Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, the cult TV phenomenon which came out as a sort of an underground show on Channel 4 and sort of blew up into this cultural phenomenon. Here, Charlie Brooker essentially gives us a collection of short films, all based around technology, as he shows us, in many ways, the darker side of what we consider to be typical granted with everyday technology. On tonight's episode, though, we will be looking at the first ever episode, The National Anthem, in which the Prime Minister has to have sex with a pig, as well as looking at the Season 2 episode, White Bear. But before we obviously get into that, we'll start as always with by asking what you've been watching. So, Lucky, I mean, what's obviously been holding your attention since the last show?
The show that I really kind of became hooked on, I've still kind of been dabbling quite a bit. There's still some things that I need to kind of continue with. I got stalled in the second season of Mr. Robot, and I couldn't even complete the pilot for Dirk Gently. Couldn't complete the pilot for The Exorcist. So those two are still kind of on the list. The thing that really hooked me is, and I just finished it last night, is Channel Zero Candle Cove.
Yeah,
I mean, based on the creepypasta, and that is, I wouldn't say it's a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination, but it kind of hits that sort of Stephen King retro 80s kind of sweet spot, the same kind of sweet spot that Stranger Things hits.
Yeah,
it's very much like Stephen King's It, going back and forth, flashing back between the past and the present, and with people, adults facing this big evil thing that they faced as kids. Has it come to the British shores?
It has, actually. I think we got it around the same time that it launched in the States, which is kind of a miracle with the way we release everything over here. And it's a show that I'm glad that you brought up, because it's one that I've seen, I think, the first two or three episodes of. I've been recording it, but it's not really grabbed me as a show. I've kind of enjoyed elements of it, and while I've certainly enjoyed it more than other shows, such as, you know, like Walking Dead, I've just not felt the need to sort of prioritize it over watching other things at the moment. So the three I've watched, though, there's been elements that I've certainly enjoyed. As you said already, it's got that real same sort of element to it that made it so special, the idea of these children going back and facing this childhood fear. In particular, in this case, it's the children's puppet show, Candle Cove. Am I right in saying, is that right?
Yeah.
Which, for my money, is the creepiest element of the show. There's a lot of bizarre flashbacks, and we've obviously got the monster made up of children's teeth that's sort of wandering around, and I'm still to find out how that plays into everything. But we have this children's puppet show called Candle Cove that features throughout the series, and it basically comes through the TV static and just randomly appears. And these characters have all got memories of watching it as children, and now it seems to obviously be affecting the youth of today, giving all these sort of like cryptic instructions. And while on the surface it looks kind of, you know, like some throwaway 70s kids puppet show, there's something about these puppets that they can go really dark really suddenly.
Oh, yeah.
I think the...
And you haven't even... If you stopped at, like, episode 3, you haven't even really hit the dark stuff yet.
Oh, great.
So...
I mean, this is sure. I got freaked out about a giant puppet appearing in the guy's bedroom.
Yeah, yeah, that was a really... They did a really good job with the... have you read the original story?
This is what I'm trying to piece it together, because I've read bits and pieces of Creepypasta. I'm not, again, a huge fan of Creepypasta. I think I'm the wrong demographic for it. So I went into it thinking it was based on the kid who remembers the show Mr. Hand.
One I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, because there's this short story about this guy, and he remembers this kid's show, and it featured this character called Mr. Hand, and these puppets would basically brutalize each other. And I thought, going into it, that's what it was. I also thought that this was an anthology series, and that each episode would be different. So I've been kind of surprised to go into it and find it, oh, it's actually an ongoing story. And from what I gather, I think it's going to be like American Horror Story. Each season is going to be a self-contained story, which will be great. Especially if they can do it well, because obviously American Horror Story is using that format, but it's doing it badly.
Right.
And obviously this show is not... We're having the need to just resort to like graphic violence and sex and nudity to...
Well, it's got a very different kind of creative team behind it. The main people behind it, Nick Antosca, who wrote for Hannibal.
Okay.
Is the guy who actually developed it. And then the other two major writers, from what I can tell, seem to be Harley Payton, who was one of the lead writers on Twin Peaks back in the day, and Don Mancini, creator of the Child's Play franchise.
Yeah.
And then also, I don't know how involved he is creatively, but Max Landis is also listed as an EP on it. Although I haven't seen him, I haven't seen his name, I don't believe I saw his name come up in any of the writing credits or anything like that. He doesn't seem to be as creatively involved in this as he is with the Dirk Gently show. So you have a very different kind of aesthetic, a very different kind of, you know, kind of, horror type thing than with the American Horror Story, which is very much, from what I'm led to believe, pretty much typical of Ryan Murphy, Brad Falchuk, basically having these kind of big emotional moments that only vaguely kind of connect to each other, really seems to be the way people have described, like, Nip Tuck and Glee to me.
Just obviously looking into the background of this, we were right in saying this is actually a very short season. It's only 6 episodes.
Right.
They have already greenlit a second series, and as we predicted, it's a new story, which is great again. It's going to be titled The No End House, which is currently scheduled for 2017. The synopsis on Wikipedia at the moment reads, a young woman named Margaret Sleedo, who will be played by Amy Forsyth, visits the No End House, a bizarre house of horrors that consists of a series of increasingly disturbing rooms. When she returns home, Margaret realizes everything has changed. That's it.
Yep.
That's all we got.
That's another creepypasta story I know.
Okay.
And the reason is I did a creepypasta cram over the summer because I was working. I have this one of the creative projects that I've been trying to kind of work with is I wanted to do a tabletop role playing game, not like a new game, but do it a campaign, I guess, or just something for my friends. And I wanted to do something that was very kind. I wanted to basically do kind of like almost like a modern non-camp Scooby-Doo type thing,
right,
which is or like, you know, Stranger Things. You know, it would take place in the modern day, but I wanted to do like teenage characters like investigating this dark secret in this small town. And I had just finished off Marble Hornets, and I thought, you know, I could go and I could read a bunch of creepypasta to see if I can get some ideas.
Yeah.
And that's where I hadn't, that is not where I initially read, I initially read Candle Cove like 3 or 4 years ago. And when I heard they were doing Candle Cove, I was like, okay, I'm all in on that. But yeah, the No End House is another one that I'd read.
Okay.
And that one's pretty freaky as well.
Yeah.
They've done a really, this is a really good job of just, like, picking, like, two of the creepypastas that really, you know, the best creepypastas kind of have this sort of urban legend feel to them.
Oh, I know, yeah.
You know, it's not just somebody just coming up with some goofy thing to scare people. That is why Slender Man took off the way it did.
Yeah.
Because there is just kind of something about the way that it all kind of comes together, the original mythology comes together, that kind of makes you think.
I mean, just on the topic of Slender Man, I mean, just to interrupt you there for a minute, is I'm so glad the series didn't go, okay, we're doing Creepypasta, let's do Slender Man. Because I don't want to see a Slender Man series. I think it's getting so overworked. It's become this cultural phenomenon.
Well, there's been several web series done on Slender Man, at least two or three that I can think of, particularly Marble Hornets, which seems to be the definitive one. There's already been, Marble Hornets has turned into something of a minor franchise. They've already done one Marble Hornets film, not anything hugely budgeted other than the fact that it had Doug Jones in it. And I know there's another one in the works. So yeah, almost certainly, if nothing else, they probably couldn't work out a deal. They might have done it, but they might have investigated the idea of doing the Slender Man series, but the rights are almost certainly tied up with other production companies.
Yeah, and the one creepypasta that sort of stood out to myself, and it's the one where they put these prisoners of state. It's supposedly based on this Russian experiment where they put these prisoners of state into an isolation chamber.
Uh-huh.
And that they basically they came out mad, and that they found this like alternate state of being, but like
right.
But they had no way to see what was happening in the chamber, and that basically they were like mutilating themselves and stuff, and it would just really creep me out. And I wish I could remember what it was.
And I read that one as well. I'm not recalling the title of it.
No, which is really frustrating, because I stumbled across the these recommended stories through Listverse. Because if you're on Creepypasta,
right.
There's so much stuff on Creepypasta because people are just constantly adding to it. So, without knowing what to look for, it can be a bit overwhelming. So it's often best if someone like recommends a few things for you and gives you somewhere to go from there. So,
Russian sleep experiment?
Yeah, it was like a Russian sleep experiment.
I think it's just called Russian sleep experiment.
Okay.
There's a Creepypasta wiki at creepypasta.wikia.com. And I brought that up, and it's the story you're talking about.
Yeah, the Russian sleep experiment, you're right there. So, and yeah, the concept being the Russian researchers in the late 1940s keep 5 people awake for 15 days using experiment gas stimulant. And yeah, basically they go mad, and it gets pretty gruesome.
Uh-huh.
And it's a rather creepy little tale. I don't think that's going to make it onto Channel Zero. But, yeah, shows the range of what is on Creepypasta, really, I guess.
Yeah, the one I'm hoping that they do, the one that I'm hoping that they figure out a way to do is the Booth World Industries one. So you get a call from a phone number, and you can have people, if I remember correctly, it's basically like they have remodeling is what they call it.
Okay.
And they just call you randomly, and they ask you to have someone scheduled for remodeling. You know, that's a name for someone to remodel. And that's just basically to have them killed. And the one, the reason that one, Booth World, sticks out in my head is that it's the phone number is in my American area code. So whoever wrote this, it clearly lives by me.
In many ways, I think Creepypasta's really picked up on what was essentially established by, like, the Clive Barker Books of Blood. When I read some of these things, and I can't help but like think back to like some of the Clive Barker short stories, such as like In the Hills, the Cities, with the people like melding themselves together to form these giants. And I heard on the Bonus Material podcast the other day when they were doing their Clive Barker special that there are actual film development rights floating around for that particular story, and it's like, how can that possibly work? So
well, they made a Rawhead Rex movie.
They certainly did.
That's the reason Clive Barker keeps a lot closer tabs now on who he sells his film rights to, because they completely, I guess, scotched the Rawhead Rex movie. I've never seen it, but yeah, there's this sort of like kind of weird feeling. I always felt that that Midnight Meat Train kind of had that feeling to it.
Yeah. I think, Midnight Meat Train. My gran's seen that. I've yet to see it. But she asked me shortly after it came out on DVD, she asked me if I'd seen it. Which is always an interesting conversation to have with your gran, but,
Yeah. That was one of Midnight Meat Train, if I remember correctly, that ran at the Chicago 24-hour... I always want to say 24-hour party people. 24-hour horror film marathon that you and I were discussing, I was telling you about before we started recording. And that was where I actually got to meet. Clive Barker was there presenting it, so I got to, like, meet Clive Barker for literally, like, 2 seconds. We shook hands.
How did you find him? I find him, like, a really down-to-earth and nice guy. And you would
very charming. Yeah. Very charming guy.
I was like, even when you meet him and you think, oh my god, this guy's going to be like darker than the devil's spit, but like Nick Cage, really nice guy.
Yeah, a lot of these horror writers, you kind of expect, you know, Stephen King, Ramsey Campbell was another one that they really kind of surprised that basically people expected him to be like Anton LaVey.
Yeah.
And he's just this sort of long-haired, kind of hippie-ish guy from Liverpool. You know, very soft-spoken. And, horror writers are usually like that.
I think this is what we always said. If you spend all your time being, like, creepy in your creative work, then when you're in your downtime, you don't really feel the need to be creepy anymore, do you? You're just, like... just have some normality in your life. I mean,
there's always exceptions to that, like Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, you never know which version of Alan Moore you're going to get. Some days he's
that's very true.
He's very satirical and funny, and then there's other days where he's, like, kind of out there. And it's always kind of a crapshoot which Alan Moore you're going to get. I remember him saying about his religion that he'd set up where he's basically worshipping the multi-breasted snake goddess, but he's not sure if it's actually something that exists or just a sock puppet on his other hand.
That's right, Mr. Moore.
So, like, you see what Alan Moore did and what he's done with existing properties like Swamp Thing, what he did with The Watchmen. And when he's, like, talked about these things being adapted, and he's, like... because he basically doesn't take payment for it. He says, give the money to the artists and other people involved and stuff. And when he was, like... I mean, he was on, like, Radio 2 or Radio 4, and he was, like, talking about it. It was, like, being really funny about it, and it was sort of, like... he was, like, saying, these projects, they just keep getting greenlit, and it was sort of, like, begrudgingly, each one that comes along, it's, like, give the money to the artists... And then other times he'd give the same quote, but he'd just sound really angry and pissed off. So he's
right.
Yeah. He's an odd one to say which one you're going to get. So it always kind of puts me off wanting to pursue that particular interview, but because as they say, you should never meet your heroes.
That's a motto I live by.
So, yeah, I just try to stumble into these encounters. So.
But yeah, Candle. I really like Channel Zero Candle Cove. It really picks up in the second half.
Oh, good.
I can see why you would have had some difficulty getting really hooked in the first three episodes.
Yeah.
But I liked it. It was really neat, and it had some stuff that really kind of put my teeth on edge, particularly in the finale.
Oh, good.
So that's one I definitely, and it's only six episodes.
Yeah, which is kind of refreshing.
So, yeah, and I'm really glad. I'm really glad that like kind of like the shorter season models are coming over here.
Yeah.
That's one, and it's going to be. I know that there's going to be when they do the No Name House one or No End House. It's not going to be like a full year before we get that. I think they're going to run that in like February or March.
Right.
Kind of breaking these up into two like mini series. That's really nice. That's really been the only thing for me, other than like I've been watching Survivor as well. We're right in the middle of the latest season of Survivor, which is about the only reality show I watch, and they had some really really great cluster kind of episodes.
Yeah.
Where nobody everything's in chaos and nobody knows who's voting for who, and I've even at this point given up trying to figure out who's going to make it all the way. So ask Dan at a public transportation snob if he's willing to wager who he thinks is going to win Survivor this season, but I'm not even going to try.
Let's go. I mean, for myself, it's not been a particularly exciting month. Obviously, I'm still watching Westworld. That's nearing its big conclusion, and it's still doing interesting things. It's just extremely dense, I'm finding it. There's a lot going on, and how it all comes together.
That's what I've been hearing about it.
Yeah, and I wish I had more time to like rewatch episodes, but with the pacing of everything and everything else I've got to watch, it's sort of like a case of I sort of watch it and then I have to try and pick it up on the message boards and whatnot to piece it all together. But I still enjoying it. It's still a very good series. Also on after it, I've been watching the Sarah Jessica Parker new series Divorce, which is a fun little black comedy, and very much in the vein of Sensitive Skin. Liked that particular series, then I would check it out.
What? I don't think I've ever heard of Sensitive Skin.
Okay. It's,
is that a British show?
No, this is a Canadian black comedy. It stars Kim Cattrall.
Okay.
I never really cared for on Sex and the City, but again, she's really good on this show. And she's basically this woman, she's in her 50s, and basically having kind of like a midlife crisis, and she's surrounded by all these people who are making out the fact that they've got everything worked out, but she realizes no one really does, and it's kind of like a better written version of Girls, I guess, in that respect.
I was going to say, it sounds what you're describing is like a version of Girls for like the very last, like, or like the very like last gasp of the baby boomer generation.
I mean, we're starting to see a lot more of these sort of mumblecore shows being made now. And Divorce again would put over it. And it's just nice sort of shows which sort of revel in the use of dialogue rather than action and whatnot. Just having characters interact with each other and having interesting dialogue is just so kind of refreshing. And obviously, Girls is returning for its final season next year at the start.
Okay.
Of the trailer for that. It's drifted so far from its first season. I was looking back on my Facebook memories and seeing me praising how great a show it was. And I kind of cringe now when I see what the hell it's turned into. Because it's so far up its own ass, and it has a lot to do with its creator in that respect, because Lena Dunham has basically started to believe her own hype. It reflects now in the writing, and I think she lost, you can tell where her writing power ran out, which is around season 2, because it's been treading water ever since, but there's still those who will proclaim it's the greatest thing ever, such as like Bret Easton Ellis, but Bret Easton Ellis is the kind of guy who thinks you can watch the first episode and the last episode of the season, as he did with Breaking Bad, and be able to give a comprehensive opinion on it, as he frequently states his dislike for that show. But when's the last time he wrote anything of note?
Never heard of the guy.
So
I guess there's your answer. Girl seems to have gone the route. It's basically like the non-supernatural mumblecore heroes, basically. Yeah. It's like everybody loved it for like 3/4 of a season.
Yeah. It's just not offering anything of interest. The exception, obviously, being that Gotham is returning for season 3. Titled Mad City.
Yep, and I've heard about that.
In the first trailer, we see the return of the previously dead Jared, who's the only character we've seen confirmed is coming back. We've obviously heard that Poison Ivy's character is being reworked, so she's now going to be more of a environmental activist, and being having a jump in the old age, because they're promoting her from being a young child to being a teenager. So,
all right.
It'd be interesting. Gotham, as I've obviously rambled on previous episodes about, is one of my favourite of the superhero shows. It is just so perfect, and at the same time, they're cramming so much into each season. It's like you're getting 2-3 seasons worth in one season. And the fact that it's got this Sin City style to it, and it's not just like filled with beautiful people, it's very much its own show. It's what I really like about it, and I know it's got its haters and people criticizing aspects of it, but I like to believe it exists in its own universe. This is just one way of telling the early years of Batman. This is just one way, and the Ben McKenzie is fantastic as both James Gordon, but Donnell Logue as Harvey Bullock is one of my favorite things about the show, and it's so good whenever he's just playing like sleazy cops or drunk Irish cops in particular. Because he did a turn on Special Victims.
Donald Logue. He did. I don't remember whether it was last season or the year season before.
Yeah.
He was kind of like the acting chief. After I don't remember his name, but Dan Florek's character, and while they were going through the formalities of formally giving Liv that job, and they did some stuff there. Yeah, I remember him doing that, and his character knocked up Rollins, and it's just anywhere you find Donald Logue, you know, he showed up on Vikings a couple years ago. And that was a lot of fun. And he managed to make the last few episodes his was the main plot arc going on Sons of Anarchy, where I just said, okay, screw this. I can't deal with this show anymore.
Yeah.
Donald Logue is always great. And I think if nothing else, Gotham seems to be making a star out of the guy, Robin Lord Taylor, I think his name is, the guy that plays Cobblepot, the Penguin. That guy's a weird. I mean, he's not bad looking, but he's a kind of interesting guy.
I think. You're right in saying. I mean, Robin Lord Taylor, who is obviously playing the young Penguin, Cobblepot. He steals every scene he's in. He's been. Fantastic arc throughout the series, as we've seen him obviously going from the various different criminal fraternities, as he's been trying to find his place in the underworld. And we obviously had that wonderful part of the second season where he was essentially roommates with the Riddler. And it was, as we said...
Okay, why am I... You sold me. You sold me on Gotham. I'm going to start watching it at some point.
Yeah. And as we said...
The Penguin being housemates with the Riddler.
Oh, yeah.
My God. I don't even know that there's a more perfect log line for a television show.
Well, this is what we mentioned before when it happened. I mean, it's like the Odd Couple, but they're both psychotic.
it's like Bottom all over again.
Pretty much. Yeah, it's a great show. And it's available on Netflix now as well, which makes...
Oh, awesome. Okay, good. So, well, I have cable now, so...
It should but yeah, just obviously, just a final note, dialogue. I'm just so glad that he's finally getting to be an actor in his own right, rather than them basically trying to use him as a bargain bin Jeff Bridges. Because for like the longest time, they were trying to get him to just be... do like Jeff Bridges' role, where they can obviously get Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see him actually doing some like proper drama and stuff. And
right.
And Sean Pertwee as Alfred has been also truly phenomenal on the show.
I don't know. I mean, that's my question that I always ask people: is why the hell am I not watching Gotham? I mean,
yeah.
Sean Pertwee's on it.
It,
I mean, I like him, and not just because I'm a Doctor Who fan. Yeah. I mean, he was the couple movies I've been able to track him down in. You know, he's really good. I thought he was really good in Neil Marshall's Dog Soldiers.
Oh, definitely. I think another of the highlights though of season two was when we got to meet Penguin's father. And he's played by Pee Wee Herman.
By Paul Reubens, yeah.
Yeah, who's obviously played the role in Batman Returns.
Oh, that's right.
So to see him reprise it again as an older actor, and it's phenomenal. It's not, there's no element of Pee Wee Herman to this character at all. It is like straight down the line a serious performance he gives.
Yeah, well, Reubens, I think, is a better actor than I think a lot of people have given him credit for, but he's always going to... There's a group of people to whom he's always going to be Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, yeah. I think so, but, no, he's, he's just one of many, many highlights that have been with this show. I think it really came into its own in the second season, but, no, both seasons have had... They've had something there to sort of hook you in.
Right.
It's felt like in those early episodes, like you're watching like a police procedural set within Gotham City.
Right.
Yeah, it's one that's definitely worth stick with those first few Rocky episodes where they're establishing people, and once it gets going, it's very hard to not get hooked and stuff. And how they're bringing characters in, how they're explaining like other characters. Creation has just been very, very good. So
isn't there a rumor that Jim Gordon's wife is going to end up being Harley?
Well,
or someone goofy like that will end up turning into Harley Quinn.
It wouldn't surprise me because she obviously goes a little nuts in it. And again, we have the standout scene where she's torturing Jim Gordon, so she's dressed in a wedding dress with a sawn off shotgun, interrogating Jim Gordon. I mean, these are scenes that you never knew you wanted to see them until it gives you them.
Right.
And we obviously have things like we have like minor characters like Firefly revamped. We have BD Wong turn up as Hugo Strange. Who's just a very inspired choice, and we have Jada Pinkett Smith as Fish Mooney, who's like,
oh god,
who's again, she's really phenomenal in the show. She's really takes this character and like gives us this kind of like a blaxploitation style roughness to her.
Right.
She's like, she's got this like shot like quality where she's like beautiful and deadly all at the same time. Right. She's like playing one of these rival gangsters in it, and yeah, she's. I know, obviously, you hear Jada Pinkett Smith, and you think, oh, that's Will Smith's wife, and what could she possibly bring? But here she's just really good. She's good.
Cool.
Obviously, other than that, it's the only other thing I've really been sort of watching is the King of the Road tournament 2016, which is currently shown on Viceland. For those not familiar, it's kind of like a Jackass-style scavenger hunt held by Thrasher magazine, where they have different skater teams from companies such as Birdhouse and Toy Machine go across the country, visiting 13 different cities, and they have to complete different challenges, and such as they have like Jackass-style stunts where they have to check into a hotel wearing only stickers, or to spend 5 days completely shirtless, or to perform different skateboarding tricks, or to recreate famous tricks at particular skate sites. And yeah, it's been fun. If you like skateboarding or like Jackass, it's kind of got the feel of the old Big Brother skate videos, like Poop and Number Two. To it. So it's been good. But Viceland is continuing to provide me with most of my TV watching, with shows such as like Hate Your Neighbor and Wang's World, and we've got the new series Abandoned coming up about them looking at abandoned places across the states. So yeah.
I'll have to look that one up. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, and the Viceland film series is absolutely phenomenal as well, where they take different directors and do a overview of their works. They do like the Coen brothers and Richard Linklater, Sofia Coppola.
Uh-huh.
It's a real great introduction if you're not familiar with a director such as like Linklater, for example. It's
right.
Actually this nice little overview and insights into his work, and it sort of like establishes what the themes are, and while obviously going from like the first film through to the most recent work. So yeah, it's there's definitely some great stuff in there, especially with like the Coens and Linklater and Tarantino and those sort of directors that have all these sort of references and indie sort of backgrounds to them. So
But cool.
Yeah, I think that's about it at the moment. It's, as I said, it's been a bit of a quiet month, so
yeah.
We're currently looking more to the year ahead with our releases and stuff than what's currently coming out at the moment. So I think at the moment it's just going to be a case of wrapping up Westworld. Perhaps over the Christmas break I'll catch up on The Walking Dead. I can take it or leave it at this moment in time, and I think it's got about 2 seasons in it, I reckon. And I think if the showrunners are sensible, they follow the comics up to the Total War storyline and end it there, because it's has kind of like a conclusion in the comic books where we obviously hit that point and then we jump forward several years to like a rebuilding of society.
Right.
So I think the show, the TV show can't really run as long as the comic book is going. I think it's losing its audience, and certainly it needs to do something to keep the audience there, because at the moment it's quickly fading, and it's, as the numbers are showing, it's just the diehards that are really with it, and there's a lot of people deluding themselves.
Yeah.
It's still good, but it's yeah, it's not been good for a long time.
Right.
So but yeah, I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about on that one?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. But obviously something worth talking about would be Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, which has seen the first half of its commissioned season through Netflix released already. We've had the first 6 episodes of the 12-episode season that they've commissioned. But on tonight's show, we're obviously looking back at episodes from the first 2 seasons. Kicking things off, though, we're going to obviously start with the pilot episode called The National Anthem. Now, in this particular episode, we've got the Prime Minister, who is faced with this huge dilemma when Princess Susanna, who is this much-loved member of the royal family, is kidnapped, and her kidnapper for her safe return says that the Prime Minister must have sexual intercourse with a pig on national TV. And he's put all these specifications in place so that it's impossible for them to fake it. Callow basically has to go for it, or the princess is going to die. And the episode follows this huge dilemma of will he go through with it or not? What is he... Is there a way he can sort of get out of it? And as I said, this is the whole plot line of it. This episode in particular has, like so many of the Charlie Brooker stories, had this surprise link to real life where, obviously in 2015, in September, the current president, the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, was revealed to have taken place in a initiation rite where he was said to have put his private part, in hashtags there, into the mouth of a dead pig. And obviously this linked, as the papers very happily did, to this Charlie Brooker's episode where we obviously have the Prime Minister being forced to have sex with a pig on television. This is certainly an unusual way to open your series. Lucky, I mean, what was your sort of thoughts on this one?
It's a really interesting opening salvo. It basically kind of... You know, the original run, this is about the first series of Black Mirror was this episode. I think it's called the 11 Million Merits and The Complete History of You. And this was about the most extreme of the three episodes. There's really nothing in... in the entire series, there are, you know, numerous things that are disturbing or shocking. But really, I don't think there's any single point in this series that kind of has, I mean, to kind of point out how this episode opens, where you've got Roy Kinnear?
Yeah, Roy Kinnear.
Rory Kinnear, you know, playing Prime Minister Michael Callow, you know, being woken up in the middle of the night by a phone call at 10 Downing Street and, you know, going and talking to his major advisors who are played by Lindsay Duncan. I know Lindsay Duncan has done other stuff, but to me, she's always been like the doomed Martian mission commander in one of the gap year season specials from Doctor Who Waters of Mars back in 2009. And the other advisor being played by Donald Sumpter, another Doctor Who veteran, but who most people would recognize as, I think, Maester Luwin from the first couple seasons of Game of Thrones. And just the way they're leading up to this whole thing, like they show you the video with Princess Susanna crying, and then they pause it right before they get to the revelation, and they're like, okay, now we believe that what follows is completely on the level. And this whole thing is like, you have to go and have unsimulated sex with a pig. And it's like... I want to pause at that point and say that is Charlie Brooker basically almost like a statement of purpose. You know, that's the point at which Charlie Brooker just basically kind of pauses things and say, okay, this is the kind of thing you're going to be dealing with on this show. You know, and there's nothing, I don't think there's anything even in the rest of the series. There's a lot of disturbing stuff, but nothing as extreme as this one moment. But, I mean, that kind of sets a bar of kind of what kind of twisted shit to expect.
Yeah.
And certainly there is a lot of twisted stuff in this, but it really, the thing that really gripped me about this particular episode and why this said, you know, why within about half an hour I was just like, okay, I'm all in on this show. You know, is that it takes this almost high concept type thing. You almost want to say, you want to pitch it, and you want to pitch it with like three exclamation points at the end of your log line. Prime Minister fucks a pig. Favorite Cameron has sex with a pig on live television. But it treats it as proper drama.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly the novelty of the whole thing. The novelty of the whole thing where it cuts in between, you know, Callow and his, you know, advisors discussing what the hell is this and how are we going to deal with this? I mean, this is, you know, and all these kind of implications and then cutting in between like these sort of, you know, average people type characters, you know, Greek chorus characters saying, can he do this? You know, watching this and, you know, talking about it. Is this going to happen? Is it not? Is this a joke? Is this some sort of, you know, sort of, you know, Gilbert and George type bizarro performance art type thing, you know, and it just takes this absolutely bizarre round the bend concept, and you're just clearly through the looking glass here, but it's okay, if somebody did this, how would the press treat it? And I some of my favorite scenes in the episode are early on when they're having, you know, they cut between several plots, and one of the plots that they, the subplots they have throughout the episode is the one of the TV networks, you know, trying to figure out how to cover this, and they're all in a boardroom, and they're trying to figure out how can you sensitively say someone has captured Princess, someone has captured, you know, a member of the royal family, and will kill her if the Prime Minister does not fuck a pig on live TV. Mm. How do you sensitively say that?
Yeah. I'm just going to, obviously, warn ahead that we are going to be doing spoilers for both episodes. So if you haven't seen either of these episodes, do yourself a favor, go and watch them, and then restart this podcast. Because
yeah, we'll still be here. We're not going anywhere.
Because, I mean, after you watch these episodes, there's sort of, you watch these episodes and you want to discuss them with someone. And it's, as I said, we've obviously got this, the Prime Minister has to fuck a pig. That's the hook for this episode. But where the genius of Black Mirror lies is that it can take, it gives you that hook, and it's where Brooker takes the story that things get really interesting. How he chooses to portray this, handling the situation. As you mentioned already, we've got these different groups trying to decide how they're going to proceed with the coverage or handling the situation. We see, obviously, the Home Secretary trying to find all these ways to get the Prime Minister out of it. Like, they try to fake the Prime Minister having sex with a pig. They bring in a porn star who has this really fantastic name and just...
Rod something.
Yeah, he's Rod Senseless.
Rod Senseless, the Andy Serkis of porn.
They basically bring in, but obviously this kidnapper, he's always one step ahead. I mean, he sets up a fake broadcast point, so there's a moment where you follow the SWAT team going, and they think they're going to take out the broadcast and find the princess, but obviously not. It's just another plot.
Uh-huh.
It's all just another game the kidnapper's playing, and it's fascinating as the clock's obviously ticking down to him obviously having
right.
And you don't know. I mean, it's like what does he do? And everyone's sort of like turning up against him. Like, the royal family say they're not going to protect him if he doesn't go through with it. And that they even say, like, his family will have no protection from any repercussions if he turns.
Yeah, we can't guarantee your safety.
Yeah.
Pause. Or that of your family.
And he's sort of like,
you know.
Yeah, and he's sort of like, Callow's essentially over a barrel. He doesn't want to fuck a pig.
Right.
But he kind of has this sense of duty, and I don't know, is it really a sense of duty or the fact that he's forced into performing this act? I'm never sure which way to view it.
And it's always intercutting with the media talking about it.
Yeah.
The media talking about his approval numbers. The media talking about you know, how people will see him. And I mean, this is, you know, this is particularly very vital, I think, for American viewers, you know, because you really get, I think, a good primer in this episode of how the subtle differences between, like, the relationship between the American press, American government, British press, and the British government, where a lot of the sort of freedoms of the press that we assume we have in America, we don't have, like, the D notices, you know, which they're very strongly worded, you know, missives that'll come down from Whitehall or whatever to the press and say, yes, you know, it's like these very, almost like very strongly worded, but very passive aggressive. It's, we would really appreciate you not, you know, spill these state secrets, you know, that kind of thing. And just kind of, you know, another one of the more interesting, you know, B plots is, you know, between basically like a functionary in the cabinet, or just like an aide to an aide to an aide, and, you know, tipping off a source at a network, basically by her basically seducing him into it, you know, by sexting him, you know, and it's just, you know, again, the thing I keep going back to is it's the most bizarre possible idea you could possibly think of. You know, it's like I could not even wake up and think to myself, okay, I'm going to write a story. What am I going to write a story about? I'm going to write a story about somebody blackmailing the president of the United States into fucking a pig on CNN. And Brooker takes it. And this is where I have to go to Brooker's background, because if I remember correctly, Brooker got his start with, you know, kind of like the whole, you know, brass eye Chris Morris gang. You know, I know one of his previous projects he worked with Chris Morris on.
Yeah.
And how I heard Brooker's name, first heard Brooker's name in association with a show called Dead Set, which ran, I think, 2008 or 2009, which is basically Dawn of the Dead, how Dawn of the Dead affects the Big Brother house.
Yeah.
Which, again, sounds absolutely, it's this amazing satire,
well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, Brooker, when you look at his filmography, he's always been part of that satirical crowd, because Britain, on a whole, we're very big on satire. It's seen as a very noble form of comedy to be satirical about, especially like the government state. It's a very big thing, and Brooker is very much like coming in after the early 90s sort of comedy punk movement we discussed in the previous episode with things like Bottom and
right.
Fran Laurie. And he's sort of like coming in, he's very sort of like the late 90s, because obviously he started off on the 11 o'clock show. From there, he obviously goes on to be working with Chris Morris, the chief agitator himself. He works on Brass Eye. In particular, he worked on the episode Peter Geddon, which pissed everyone off.
Oh, God, yeah.
And from there, he obviously continued to stay on very much a technology track with things such as, like, the site TV Go Home. He did Dave and Barley. Again, that's with Chris Morris. That's Chris Morris over on the dark end of things. It's with Chris Morris, you either have, like, satire that you can follow, or just the darker recesses of his mind were like Aphex Twin vacations with things like,
yeah,
Jam and Nathan Barley. That it's a really dark place that he will go to with those shows.
Even with Brass Eye, when I watched Brass Eye, there were points at which I was like, is this supposed to be comedy or anti-comedy?
Yeah.
You know, that is just, and you're very right, there is this very long and storied tradition of scathing satire in British-Irish culture, going back to Jonathan Swift, that you don't really have in America. I mean, Brooker is in the same tradition as Chris Morris, as the more political alt comedy figures, going all the way, you know, like going all the way back to like Swift. I mean, this is just, this is intense stuff.
Yeah, and obviously Brooker has always had this love of technology. He's done numerous reviews for like computer games. He did he even did like a little documentary on computer games, how video games changed the world, which I really recommend checking out. I think you can find it on like Snack Film or somewhere. If you just type in how video games changed the world, you'll be able to find it. It's on one of those legal video hosting sites, so it is available to watch.
I think he also did like a column for like PC Magazine or PC Computing or one of the British computer magazines.
I'm not too sure which one. I know that he got put in Sniper Elite because he did a whole column where he talked about how much he enjoyed shooting Nazis in the balls. So they put him in Sniper Elite 3. So now you can shoot Charlie Brooker in the balls.
All right, yeah. Okay, we're through the looking glass here. Amazing.
And he also did, he used to write for the Guardian. He did a piece in The Guide where he would write his thoughts on a particular advert. He did one on Actimel yogurts, and it was sort of like, oh, Jenny's tummy feels like it's stuffed with a football, or perhaps Jenny just needs a good clear out. Or that Toblerone, the only... In the advert for Toblerone, it shows Toblerone being cut with an axe, which is obviously the only logical way to eat said chocolate.
Yeah.
But, here he's obviously... The focus is on technology. I think Dead Set was really a test run for what we get here.
Dead
Set in the Big Brother house overrun with zombies. And with this...
It's a Dead Set. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's Dead Set. The one thing I want to say about Dead Set... is that it's obvious in Dead Set that he enjoys Big Brother, but it's one of those things I never knew was possible until I saw Dead Set to be both affectionate and scathing.
it was so unusual. It was a decent zombie drama, but obviously set in the realm of Big Brother. It's sort of like, what would happen if Big Brother's the last sanctuary on Earth?
It's amazing.
Yeah. Obviously, technology runs rampant throughout Black Mirror, and some episodes are a little more obvious. In this one, it's a little more subtle, because we obviously have, like, things such as, like, the ransom ban being put on YouTube, and we see, like, the effect of everyone watching it on YouTube, and it gets picked up on Twitter, so you see, like, the hashtag snout rage.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, just to... skipping ahead when we get to like crunch time, and he goes for it. You know, you're seeing Rory Kinnear. I'm sure this is something he never thought he'd be doing, having sex with a pig, as the British public all watch this happening. And it's such a great scene where they're all like cheering, and it's all this like rowdy sort of atmosphere, and it suddenly becomes very quiet, and everyone feels slightly ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
And we cut to the outside world, and it's like empty streets. And we see the princess obviously wandering these empty streets. And it turns out that the kidnapper was using this as an artistic point to show the fact that we're all busy watching screens than paying attention to the real world. And the fact that he commits suicide. So he lets the princess go before he even goes through with the act. But because we're all busy watching it, we don't realize she's been released, and that's the,
right.
That's the real kicker. And I think
he starts to broadcast at 4:00. He releases her at 3:30.
Yeah. And the fallout of this situation is not enough for the where most seems to be like, oh, the kicker is, you know, she was already released, and that would be the kicker. But here we actually see like the fallout from it. So we cut to like a year later, and Callow has like improved his political image, because he's shown what he's willing to do for the British public. They spun it in this way. They've obviously cut out the fact that he was forced into doing said act, because no one else is going to back him up if he chose not to do it.
Right.
And then you see him like this popular public figure, when like his private life, his wife is like completely cold to him. She's disgusted with him. And I love the fact that in the new season, in the episode Shut Up and Dance, you get to see a news headline briefly that actually shows that the Callows are divorcing. So, you get this
interest. I know that there have been like little tips of the hat to some of the previous episodes in the new season.
Yeah.
God, there was another one. Like somebody in the one of them was. I think it might actually have been Shut Up and Dance as well, where they had like there was like a shot of like a like people were talking on Twitter or something like that, and like there was like a brief mention of something from one of the other episodes. I'm talking out of my head again. I'm sorry.
But yeah, it's nice to see that Brooker's throwing in those little nods to the previous episodes, and that especially in this new series, it's all interconnected in a way. And yeah, I think this episode and there's another episode, I think it's in season 2, called The Waldo Effect. And yeah, in which, you know,
I gotta interrupt you again here, and I apologize.
Okay.
You know, so we discussed, you and I discussed the idea of, because, you know, Black Mirror was returning of doing like an all Black Mirror episode, and you know, we're going to get to the episode I picked in a little bit, but I got to tell you, we picked these episodes in late October, and I got to say, if I had picked a Black Mirror episode after November 8th, I don't think I would have picked the one I picked. I think I would have picked the Waldo Effect, because we just elected Waldo president.
It's scary. And when we were obviously talking about the episodes we were going to cover, there was a long period where the Waldo was going to be like one of the episodes we were going to cover.
And
That would have been, just seeing what's obviously happened on your side of the pond, just that would have been a... It's scary. I think it's scary to see how art has once again predicted history, in a way. Or preceded history. It's,
Charlie Brooker has his finger on the pulse of something very dark in Western culture. You know, and even to the point, you know, in Anglo-American culture, I mean, there are a lot of definite, you know, it's not fair to say that, you know, the only difference between American culture and British culture is the accents, you know, but it really is. There is really something, I think, really dark at the heart of Western culture.
Yeah.
And Brooker's got his finger on it. And the thing about Black Mirror is that it's almost like, you know, it's really taking a lot of things that people don't talk about, that people, a lot of people don't even know that they should be talking about or thinking about.
Yeah.
And he's bringing this stuff to light.
Yeah. I think there is, on the night of the actual election, when it was becoming clear to everyone that Trump was going to win the election, Black Mirror actually sent out a tweet proclaiming, and this is what they said, "This isn't an episode. This isn't marketing. This is reality. Trump win the election is proper Black Mirror material." As you could essentially say, we got with the Waldo moment. And the fact that they had to address it just says about how on the pulse Brooker can be at times with these episodes. But
I mean, really, that was the whole thing about watching the election coverage from, And I don't know how it differed. I don't know a whole lot about how it differed on your side of the pond. I mean, I would read, like, whenever something came in on my Facebook feed about Trump and about the election, about the campaign, from, like, The Guardian or The Economist.
Yeah.
You know, I would read stuff like that, but I don't know necessarily how, like, the BBC or the newspapers, you know, other than The Guardian, covered it. But it was just, like, at one point, I remember thinking to myself, holy shit, we're coming damn close to electing Waldo. Because it's just what Waldo taps into in that episode is the exact same thing. You know, this sort of, whole sort of, you know, this, let's just give a big middle finger and just shove it in the face of, you know, these, what we think of as being the system.
The whole election results night, I am normally up about 5 o'clock in the morning because that's what time my youngest decides he wants toast at. And
yeah.
I was checking the newswire as a dude, just going through the newswire, and the votes were still coming in and that, and I think that we obviously flicked on to put something on for the kid, and that ended. And it went back onto the news, and I thought, oh, I'll just see what's happening in the news, and it's like flashes up, Trump elected president. And it was like the end of the Waldo moment. It was just a dark moment. You just didn't think that this was going to happen, and you instantly thought that everything was going to collapse mentally. People were generally scared. I mean, this isn't our election, and people in other countries were worried about the outcome of an American election.
I within 24 hours, I had a report from a friend that a cousin who was gay had actually committed suicide as a result of the election results. You know, and the whole thing is that night was not even very dramatic. You know, I'm sitting here doing stuff on my computer, and I've got, like, the electoral results in another tab of my browser, and it was like, Trump is always ahead, and we're just waiting for that moment where Clinton is going to overtake him, and it never happens. And it's like, at the end, I'm just sitting here, and it's like, this doesn't even have, like, a satisfying arc to it.
Because, I mean, I was watching it, and these are, like, the southern states that have Trump, and that was to be expected, because it was always felt that he had a strong following in the southern states, and then you think, oh, he's going to the other states, like the Midwest and stuff, that's where we're going to get these votes from, and it's the order it's coming through, it looks worse than it is. I think I had to go into The Onion to, like, get myself out of the funk and read the article about the kid who was upset that there was no handle to pull when voting.
Which admittedly, when I started voting 25 years ago, that I wanted a handle. I've never had anything other than filling in a dart with a magic marker.
Okay.
Which just reminds me too much of aptitude tests I took when I was in friggin' grade school, so,
But, National Anthem, I think, it's a fascinating episode. Even if you know how it ends, it's still the journey it takes it on, the intrigue and the games being played in the corridors of power, I think. There's a lot of interesting aspects to this story. It's not it's more than its hook.
It's more than its hook. It's very character-oriented. And you do expect Peter Capaldi to show up at some point. You know, that's the kind of vibe it has. It has the vibe of kind of like, you're sitting there and you're watching it and you're like, this is going to turn into, you know, Thick of It at some point, right? Peter Capaldi is going to show up and he's going to be Malcolm Tucker, and he's going to swear at everybody, and we're going to have a nice little reassurance here that this is comedy. And you don't ever get that. I mean, not that there aren't ruefully funny parts of the episode, but there is never the point, there is never kind of the point where Brooker never lets us off the hook with a thing saying, yeah, I understand. This is exaggeration. This is melodrama. Now he takes an outlandish situation, and everybody approaches it, you know, as they would. And this is how you could see, if someone were to actually go through and do this, this is exactly the sort of discussions you could imagine going on at 10 Downing and in Whitehall. This is absolutely proper drama right here.
Yeah, definitely so. But any other thoughts on this one at all? Or?
No, not about the national anthem.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, though, we will be looking at our second episode of Black Mirror, which is the episode from Season 2, White Bear.
Why haven't you seen Jaws?
I've seen Finding Nemo. That's close enough, right?
Why haven't you seen The Usual Suspects?
Because I already know who Kaiser Soze is.
I can't believe you haven't seen Videodrome.
What? Has anyone seen Videodrome?
You haven't seen Psycho?
Okay. How about I start a podcast where someone will introduce me to one of these great movies I've never seen before, and in return, I'll have them watch a superhero movie. Film-wise, the Why Haven't You Seen This Film podcast. Find it on iTunes or Stitcher Radio.
And we're back. In the first half, we obviously looked at the pilot episode, Black National Anthem. We're now obviously going to flash forward to Season 2. We're an episode that you picked, Lackey, and that's the episode
yep.
White Bear.
White Bear. Now, earlier on, I mentioned how kind of like I my kind of vector into the twisted world of Charlie Brooker was a show called Dead Set, which, as I said, is basically it's Dawn of the Dead in the Big Brother house.
Yeah.
Very much this sort of modern type zombie story. And that's very much the kind of vibe that White Bear starts off with. It starts off with a young woman played by Lenora Critchlow, who I didn't recognize her at the time, but apparently she was on the UK version of the Being Human. Back when Aidan Turner and Russell Tovey were still on the show, she was the cardigan-wearing ghost. But anyway, Lenora Critchlow's character, she wakes up in a house. There's a weird sort of blocky symbol flashing on TV sets. She has amnesia. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know who she is. She has, like, these little flashes of memory that involve a little girl, and you know, she goes out and of the house and tries to figure out who she is, and she basically runs afoul of and how this is absolutely set up is marvelous. She immediately kind of wanders into something that looks like The Purge, where you've got people in, there's someone with wearing like a sheet mask and carrying like a cordless electric knife that you use for like cutting turkey, you know, and, you know, they start chasing her. She's got like chased by like two or three people. There's another guy who's wearing like a welder's mask, and, she's being pursued by like three or four people, all menacing, all have, like I said, this kind of purge sort of thing. But the majority of people she encounters, they just do nothing but film her on their phones. They just stand there, silently. They don't talk to her. They don't talk to anybody. They don't respond to any stimulus. And she's going around and she's screaming, "Who am I? I don't know who I am. Can you help me? Why don't you help me?" And, you know, and she ends up encountering, you know, some other, I guess you would call survivors of whatever this thing that's happened. The lead being played by the wonderfully named Tuppence Middleton, who is Tuppence Middleton has actually been my new crush ever since I first saw her in a movie called Tormented, which is also the first place I ever saw Alex Pettifer in. But yeah, Tuppence Middleton's got this you know, wonderful name, and you know, this really sort of big, doughy, not doughy, but like doe, like yeah, female deer type. Brown eyes and, you know, this accent. And basically what she lays out is what happened is just one day this symbol just started appearing on everything with a screen. You know, phones, tablets, computers, televisions, jumbotrons at sporting events. And it's kind of hypnotized the entire world into basically behaving like these sort of weird people who don't interact with other people, and just film you on their phones. And then a small percentage of people who were not affected by it basically decided that, well, it's libertarian paradise now. We get to do whatever we want and to whomever we want. And those are the kind of purgy type people going around in masks. And so basically, Tuppence Middleton has this plan that there's this facility called White Bear. And that's where she thinks the broadcast is going from. So there, Tuppence Middleton and Lenora Critchlow are kind of on their way to this place to try to find a shut down this transmission. Of course, and the thing I at least feel about this episode, before I turn it over to you, is that it really, really got me so involved in what's going on and what people were talking about and how things have been explained, because it is pretty much like I have even seen a film that more or less had the same kind of, just one day this broadcast comes and hypnotizes people and turns people into psychos or zombies, whatever. It was called The Symbol. A.J. Bowen was in it. Before I turn it over to you, it had me so kind of wrapped up. This episode had me so wrapped up in what people were saying that I didn't actually even really stop to think, okay, this is an episode of Black Mirror. What's really going on? So with that, I'm going to turn things over to you. What is your response to White Bear?
White Bear is obviously one of my favorite episodes of season two, which obviously included the Waldo moment, which we mentioned already. This particular episode, it's very easy when you watch it to view it like you're watching some budget horror movie, just how these characters interact, how it's all set up, and this masked gunman that's obviously chasing Victoria around, while everyone just basically stands around filming it. Like you said, they're all just basically mindless zombies. No one interacts with her at all, apart from these few survivors, as you said, that she meets along the way. And as the episode goes on, she's constantly having these flashbacks to this young girl that we assume to be her daughter. And as it goes on, we learn more and more. And the real kicker here, and spoiler alert now in case you didn't get the original warning, it turns out that this whole place is all just like a warped theme park. And that Victoria isn't actually just an innocent woman, young woman. She's this evil killer. As basically her and her boyfriend, they kidnap this young girl, who's having flashbacks about. And she filmed her boyfriend torturing and murdering this girl, with the child's stuffed toy, the White Bear, being the centerpiece of this campaign to try and find this young girl that they killed. And in a kind of Outer Limits Twilight Zone twist, societies decide that, you know, the judicial system isn't going to work for this. That the only way to get justice is to essentially build this park. So they build the White Bear Justice Park. And every day, the cycle repeats. And she doesn't know because she's drugged. And it's set up so she wakes up in the bedroom every day. And she goes through the same day over and over again. And you get this wonderful kicker at the end where it shows people attending the park and they're going through this like orientation meeting where they're being like advised of how they should interact and that, you know, they should all act like zombies and just feel free to film what's happening on their phones, which obviously everyone does. And it's that real kicker to this episode which just makes it so great. Up until that point, it's kind of B-rate, but once we get the kicker, it's just like, that was actually pretty damn sharp. And the original script didn't even have this twist ending. It's just something that came to Brooker while he was obviously scouting for locations for the episode. So, yeah.
It is just that kind of revelation that this person that it works so hard to put you on her side. You know, it's like all these zombies around her, and they're not helping her. And she's holding this picture of the little girl which she takes from the house. I don't know who I am. I think this is my daughter. And then when the kicker comes, when they have kind of the scene where they get to the White Bear transmission facility, and that's when they turn the tape. They literally kind of like put her in a chair and twist her, and she's looking at an audience. And everybody she's encountered and talked to is an actor.
Yeah.
Tuppence Middleton's character is an actor. Michael Smiley, the great Michael Smiley. Love this guy, everything he does. I have never seen him in anything I did not like in it. Just amazing scene where he just basically lays out in everything about this character, you know, about the situation, you know, who she is, what she did, and what this is that's happening to her every day. Every day, every night, they wipe her memory. Every day, she goes through this whole thing, wakes up, no memory. No idea who she is or she's essentially, and this is the thing that I think is really thought-provoking about this. She is not even remotely the Victoria Scalane, that's what we find out her name is, that helped her boyfriend in this Moore's murder type thing, if her boyfriend was, you know, Ian Brady, she was the Myra Hindley of the duo. They've completely destroyed that person. The person, the Victoria Scalane that goes to this every single day, is a completely different person. They're basically torturing someone that no longer exists. They've destroyed that person, and that's the kind of really kind of weird Twilight Zone-y thing when you really actually stop to think about it. You know, they've essentially killed, you know, the guilty party, and, you know, they're torturing an innocent in her place. You know, but that whole thing where Michael Smiley is just, you know, going through this whole thing, this is what you did, how did it feel, and she's just sobbing, you know, and just everybody, the realization that everybody that you see holding a phone, they're not a zombie, they're a tourist.
Yeah.
They've come here, they've paid to do this, presumably. I don't think you ever see them paying, but, you know, and just this whole thing, it's just, I walked away from this episode feeling like somebody had hollowed out my chest and set off a landmine in it. It was like this sort of emotional thing where it was like it just completely stunned me. And it's not very often that any form of what we would laughably call entertainment or popular culture kind of can have that effect on me, you know, where it was like, I'm just sitting here, it's like, holy shit, this is, and it really kind of touches on a lot of things, this very Scarlet Letter type thing, you know, there's this, you know, I mean, even to the point where they have her brought in, it's almost like a stockade type thing, where they, it's the end of the day, and they've gone through and they've done the confrontation. Now they're driving her back to the house where they're going to put the device on her, wipes her memory, and they have her in this sort of like glass enclosure on the back of a pickup truck or something, and people are just throwing like rotten vegetables at her and screaming at her, she's a bitch and a murderer, and someone actually says, burn the bitch at some point, so it's like really kind of twisting that witch hunt type idea, Scarlet Letter, the Crucible type thing home, you know, but it's like when you, like I said, for me the real kicker was not when I realized that for all intents and purposes, this character that we spent the entire episode is really innocent of the crime she committed, because they've destroyed that person, and it's just like, you know, it's the whole thing is punishment as entertainment, which is a whole other level of it, you know, this whole thing we're going through now. And again, another way in which, you know, Brooker has his finger on the pulse of what's going on here, this whole public shaming thing, which we could probably go into at least for another hour, this whole, you know, to the point where we're getting back to this whole thing where, you know, punishment, crime and punishment, it's coming back to entertainment. You know, we're not too far away.
Yeah.
You know, from going and broadcasting friggin', you know, executions.
Well, we constantly, what this episode for myself seems to tap into is that mentality that you have whenever you have, like, a child murderer or a paedophile that's been caught, and this idea that no matter what service sentence that this person is given, it's never enough to satisfy the public bloodlust. And that this idea that they've turned it into this justice park as a way of satisfying the bloodlust of the general public, that this person's done something so hideous that the only way to keep everyone, abide everyone, is by putting them in a situation where this person is just tortured over and over again, day after day after day. And they don't have no recollection of the day before. So they can't beg for mercy. They can't try and appeal for any sense of mercy at all. That they're just thrown into the situation day after day. And they, by the time they find out what's happening, their mind's wiped and it's just the start of a new day for them. So, yeah, I love the kicker in this one. I think it's fantastic. If I was to do a list of my top Black Mirror episodes, this would certainly be near the top.
Yeah.
I mean, this and alongside the Christmas special, which ruined Wizard's Why Can't It Be Christmas Every Day?
Yeah. Somebody was actually saying that the reason they are glad that there's an episode later on down the line in the new season called Shut Up and Dance. they were saying that they were very glad that the song Shut Up and Dance does not actually appear in the episode, because it would have ruined it for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like, and that's the thing about this. This is, I can't really explain, you know, I mean, this is definitely, I mean, in terms of, like, absolute sheer power, of an episode. I mean, like I said, and it's something where it's like you should know there's going to be a kicker coming down the line at some point. But the human drama, trying to figure out what's going on, it just had me so engrossed that I wasn't even sitting here thinking, wait a second, this can't be what it seems. This can't just be another let's run away from purge zombies type thing. There's got to be a point at which we just, you know, somebody pulls the lever and the bottom drops out.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I don't think this is something we kind of touched on early when we were talking about National Anthem. I think this one of the things that really you need a good cast to pull stuff like this off. This is very high concept stuff, to be sure, but it's high concept, but it's also human drama. You know, this is about ultimately how people relate to each other. And that you have, you know, these episodes, some of these episodes, amazing casts. You know, you've got, Be Right Back, which has Haley Atwell. And I mean, I saw this episode, and then I saw the pilot episode of Marvel's Agent Carter, and I didn't realize that Peggy Carter was Haley Atwell from that episode. And Donald Gleason, who just seemed to be the all-encompassing ginger Irish, just thing that absorbed all of entertainment because he was in every, like, third film I watched last year. And then you mentioned the Christmas special, which is one of really, really proves to people why we in America consider John Hamm a national treasure. You know, I mean, we love Mad Men here in America, but that's John Hamm, you know.
Yeah.
And just really, like, again, to have really pulled off something, even going back to National Anthem. In order to pull off National Anthem, you needed actors with the caliber of, like, Rory Kinnear and Lindsay Duncan. I can't get, and that's the same thing here. It's not, and again, I'm not entirely sure that anybody is, maybe Cuppence Middleton will get her Oscar at some point or another. I mean, for the most part, outside Britain, she mainly seems to be known for her performance in Jupiter Ascending, where she basically said, okay, if I show the audience my butt, can I get out of this movie quicker? But it's like Lenora Criswell, Cuppence Middleton really sell it. Michael Smiley, who I think may still primarily be associated with space, and I still tend to think of him as being kind of like the slightly funny, creepy, funny guy in Ben Wheaton movies. You know, this is just so, he is just so vicious in this, and he can go from being kind of like the guy in the zombie movie who, you know, the gruff guy in the zombie movie who is initially going to leave you for dead, but ultimately comes around. And then he goes, and then he's the sardonic creep with, you know, a power drill. And then when they do the reveal, and he's getting these grand gestures, he's bowing to the audience like he thinks he's playing Hamlet. You know, it's a performance, he's putting on a play, and he just goes from all these stages of the character. And it's just like, this is what you needed to pull something like this off. You couldn't have just pulled three idiots off the equity rolls and just shoved scripts in their faces and say, do this.
No.
You know, you really needed people who could do this. And that's, you know, another thing. We talk about Charlie Brooker, and Charlie Brooker, the genius, he is obviously the genius behind this whole thing. Obviously, but it's like there's so many other moving parts in this with any show that, you know, I'm always stunned by the direction. I'm always stunned by the acting, you know, and this is just, it's so typical. Like I said, it's so typical B-movie running from zombies that you think it's typical until all of a sudden it doesn't, and that's when the twist works. The twist works when you don't expect it, when you're in a position where you somehow it fools you into thinking, yeah, everything's exactly what it seems.
Yeah.
You know, if you can even think to yourself, there's a twist here, there's got to be a twist because this is a Shyamalan movie or whatever.
Yeah.
you know, then you're always at the edge thinking, okay, you're like, you know, you're like Douglas in the episode of IT Crowd. You know, oh, it's another Earth. It's an alternate universe, you know. And that's really what I think really makes this episode powerful. Not even necessarily that it's got that kind of, that the twist works so well. White Bear.
Yeah, it's, yeah, this is Booker. I think as we've covered on both episodes, this is, if anyone, any show could be, like, classified as picking up the mantle left by the, like, Twilight Zone Outer Limits, then I think Black Mirror is the show that's done it.
Definitely, and more of the, because Outer Limit, I mean, Outer Limits was just basically, yeah, Outer Limits was an anthology show, and it would have the science fiction edge to it, and, you know, science fiction often works best when it's got the undertones, but Twilight Zone specifically, Twilight Zone, Rod Serling wanted Twilight Zone to be allegorical. He wanted it to have a social conscience, and admittedly, some of the duds are when he really tries to ram the social conscience down your throat,
yeah.
You know, but it's really kind of like the best, the most powerful episodes of Twilight Zone to me were the ones like The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. The one where it, you know, the paranoid, you know, it's like trying to figure out who the alien is, or Eye of the Beholder, the one that has the twist and the moral and the social conscience and the commentary.
That. Yeah, it's funny you should mention Eye of the Beholder, because that is the episode which came to mind when I was thinking of where I'd obviously seen this sort of story before, but yeah, definitely Eye of the Beholder, I would agree with you on that one, certainly.
Uh-huh. But yeah, this is really... you haven't even, and even the Twilight Zone really couldn't bring itself to go quite this far, you know. I mean, definitely, I mean, we're talking, you know, early 60s American commercial television. You can only do so much. You can only push the envelope so much, even if you were, you know, Rod Serling. But, yeah, this is really, this is... Even if this is not necessarily the best show on television right now, it may or it may not be, you know, because everybody's got different tastes, and I'm not going to, you know, if someone's out there trying to convince me that Honey Boo Boo's the best show on TV, good for them. But this is, I can't think of anything else that's being out there that's even remotely being made that is doing this kind of thing. I mean, not even just in the sense that it's trying, it's an anthology show, and I'm glad anthology shows are coming back, but simply that it is, as a piece of, it works as a piece of entertainment, it works as a piece of art.
Well, now, then, we're good then.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, that brings us to another edition, end of another edition of the Mad, Bad, and Damn It Strange Showcase. I've, hope you've
enjoyed. Wrong podcast.
Okay, scratch that. I keep renaming them fucking wrong show as well. That's it. All shows are now under one title.
Yeah.
It's called Shut Up and Listen.
Elwood Jones and the Temple of Doom.
That's the thing. This is the podcast is playing. Shut Up and Listen.
Yeah. Shut up and listen. I don't care what we're just talking about something. I don't care what it is.
Right. Okay. That brings us to another end of another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. We hope you've enjoyed this trek through the darker recesses of Charlie Brooker's mind, as we've obviously covered these two episodes tonight. If you did obviously find them intriguing, you can find Black Mirror currently on Netflix if you're here in the UK, and I assume it's going to be on one of the streaming platforms in the States.
In the States, it's on Netflix as well. So, it's being billed as a Netflix original.
Okay.
And we've had the first two series proper for quite some time, and White Christmas appeared probably about 6-7 months ago. So this is not hard to find.
And I suppose it's rather fitting that you mentioned White Christmas, because obviously our next episode is going to be our first Christmas special. And what are we going to be obviously looking at for that one, Mackie?
Well, my choice for that is going to be a little Jim Henson production from the mid-70s, starring a number of Muppets. This is not Sesame Street or Muppet Show related, but it is called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
Nice. This is one I've actually wanted to watch, I think, since last year when it suddenly came into vogue, so I'm very much looking forward to seeing this one. So,
It's delightful. It had this sort of resurgence, and there was a resurgence in interest in it a few years ago. You know, there's this sort of, I think it's a whole part of the whole, you know, with, you know, rebooting, or not necessarily rebooting, but bringing back the Muppets for the films.
Yeah.
I think there's a little bit more. I don't think anybody really seems to be all that interested in Land of Gorch, but I think there is maybe a little bit more interest in things that were not necessarily Kermit related, but that Jim Henson did, that there's a, seems to be a resurgence of interest in things like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and, oh God, what was that thing with the Fraggle Rock? Yeah, that.
Cool. Well, Muppet Babies is coming back.
Yeah, Muppet Babies is coming back. Yeah.
So, yay.
But yeah, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, very mid to late 70s.
Okay, cool. For myself, though, I've chosen something which is one of those rare occasions where even if I told you how bad this was, it still wouldn't prepare you for how bad this show is that we're going to be we'll be watching in this double bill.
Please tell me what this is. I don't leave me in suspense here.
This is the show. This was a one-off special. It was done only once, and then they tried to bury the tape, but thankfully due to Straight Shaders, this one isn't ever going away. We are going to be looking, now I hope you're all sitting down for this one, we're going to be looking at the Star Wars Holiday Special. That's right, the show that is so bad that even no matter how bad we tell you it is, it will still not prepare you for how bad this is. And this is the platform which we first got to see Boba Fett, we get to meet Chewie's family, and we get to hear Princess Leia singing along to the Star Wars theme tune while she wobbles on about Life Day. This is going to be an absolute massive...
Chewie's son Lumpy, if I remember correctly, right?
Oh my God.
B. Arthur. I'm sure there's a lot of jokes around there we can make about B. Arthur. We'll make most of them in our next episode. Art Carney's in it. Jefferson freaking Airplane, people. This was back when Jefferson Airplane was, they were kind of in that nebulous zone where they were shifting from being kind of like the stoner, psychedelic, but harder rocking successor to Jefferson Airplane. They were on the cusp of turning into the Mickey Thomas fronted arena rock monstrosity. This is just another step on the inevitable road till we built the city on rock and roll. This is, okay, George Lucas, the fucking rabbit, the fucking talking rabbit from the Marvel comics, Jax or whatever his name was canon. This was not. George Lucas explicitly removed this from the canon.
Yeah, this one, this one is gonna get real messy real quick.
You are not, and this is why you are not going to see Lumpy or have any references to Life Day in episodes 8 or 9. I know, I personally, what was it, Chewie had like, they went to Kashyyyk for what, episode 3, right? I was hoping Lumpy was going to be there. I was hoping the Empire, I was hoping Palpatine would go in with the clone stormtroopers and they would interrupt fucking Life Day. Okay, Jefferson Airplane would have been there. No.
All this and more to come on the next episode of TV Good Sleep Bad.
Star Wars. Anyway.
Thank you again, obviously, to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey, for joining me for this episode. What's happening in your corner of the web?
I am kind of writing things a little bit for my site, which is now Lackey Writes About Film, which can be found at lackeyonfilm.com. Recently, I wrote a review of the Roger Waters concert film The Wall, which means I'm really going into some weird directions. And then over, I have also recently contributed to Cinema Axis, cinemaaxis.com, their coverage of the Toronto Independent Canadian Genre Film Festival, Blood in the Snow. I wrote reviews of, see if I can remember these names now. There was The Sublet, which was basically, it was if The Shining took place in a creepy apartment instead of a creepy hotel, it would have been The Sublet. And I always want to say Bind, Torture, Kill, but it's not that. It's Capture, Kill, Release, which is, you know, if we have to have found footage horror films, then at least they should be halfway decent ones like this one. And then there was Holy Hell, which was not the documentary. There was a documentary about a cult earlier on this year called Holy Hell. This is not it. This is a Canadian. This is basically a Troma movie. If there were a Canadian Troma, they would have made this film. And it's the only film you will see this year, and indeed for the rest of your life, where you will see a gun battle between a priest and a drag queen in a kitten mask.
Nice.
I can't make this stuff up. This is the world we live in, kids.
Cool.
Anyway, what about you, Elwood? Me fine, bucko.
Well, obviously, this being December, as of the time of recording, and that means it's the start of the alternate Christmas season on From the Depths of DVD Hell, a month-long celebration of all things rather twisted about the festive season. We've got the countdown, which has started again over on the Facebook page From the Depths of DVD Hell, and you can also follow that on my Twitter, which is at Elwood_Jones. Every day I post something old Christmas related. We've got some great fun reviews coming up. We've got some special episodes of the MBDS Showcase coming up as well, where we're going to be looking at Don't Open Till Christmas and Santa's Sleigh. So, yeah, there's a lot of old Christmas goodness coming. I don't go in for Halloween like a lot of the cool bloggers do. Old Christmas is my big holiday of the year, so I'm very excited to be now doing another round of these movies, so it's all very exciting.
Awesome.
Obviously,
have you done Elves? Have you done Elves?
I haven't. I watched Elves last year, but I forgot to review it. And Elves are the misleading title because there is only one. But yeah, it's every year. There's something new comes along, like the remake of Silent Night or Bikini Bloodbath Massacre Christmas. So
yeah. Now, it just Elves always sticks out in my head because the Dredgen reviewed it for Force Viewing, and I just remember when he came back, the tagline for the review was "Ho ho, holy shit!"
Yes. Obviously, in the meantime, though, please do, if you haven't done already, follow us on Facebook. We are at TV Sleep Good Bad. We're on Twitter, which is also at TV Good Sleep Bad. Or please hit that subscribe button if you're following us on Podomatic, or if you're following us on iTunes, hit the subscribe button. Leave us some nice words or a review. Let us know what you think of the show. It's all appreciated. The Facebook page, we are trying to, again, still make more active. We are trying to post things as they come up on there. So try and check on there and let us know what shows you would like to see covered on this podcast. We'd love to hear from you and hopefully get some of your favourites covered as well. So. But thank you again, obviously, to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Always a pleasure.
And we will be back very soon with our alternative look at Christmas, I guess, as we look at the Star Wars Holiday Special and
Emmett Otter's Jack Band Christmas.
So, yeah, definitely plenty to look forward to. But until next time, this is Edward Jones signing off another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.